It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of the toxic chemicals released in the East Palestine, Ohio train derailment is a key material for plastics production in the U.S. A Wisconsin engineer joins us for a look at how commonly it's used and how dangerous it can be. Now, when people come to visit Wisconsin, they ask, what can't miss things they should do here? There's a lot to choose from, ranging from the obvious and highly accessible to some lesser known places off the beaten path. And even for people who do live here, there's always something more to add to the list of uniquely Wisconsin places to go, sights to see, activities to do, foods to eat. Our next guest rounded up 100 great ideas. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's on your Wisconsin bucket list? What are your top recommendations for visitors? If you've recently crossed something off your list, what was it? And when people come to visit you in your part of the state, what's the gotta-do thing there? Whether it's a sight to see, an experience, a restaurant, you name it, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Danelle Gay is a TV host, travel writer, former chef, and author whose books include Midwest Road Trip Adventures. Her new book is called 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. Danelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's fun to be here.
All right, you've got 100 things. You actually have more than 100 things, because some of them, like, you know, this kind of food, yeah, here's some other restaurants too. So it's 100 plus. What did it take for something to make the cut as a must-do Wisconsin thing for your book?
It was tough. I got 191 things in there, actually. So you're right. I managed to squeeze a few more gems of Wisconsin in. And I had a huge list to start with. But you kind of had to balance things out from the state, you know, kind of all over geographically. And I wanted to do a mix of some things that were like no-brainers. You have to eat a cream puff at the Wisconsin State Fair, to some fun things that are more hinted gems. So it was a tough, delicate, like, balance to create.
Now, before we start visiting, you're doing something special with this book as you go around, and you're doing a lot of readings, and they're fundraisers, in effect. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, actually, a lot of the places that are in the book that are nonprofits, when I go back to that area and I'm doing a book event there, the profits of the book that day are going back to that organization. So even the kickoff party for my book is going to be in Sun Prairie, and that night all the sales will benefit the Sun Prairie Emergency Food Pantry.
Now, I'm hearing a lot of love for Wisconsin. Where does that come from for you?
Well, I'm born and bred here. I'm a diehard cheesehead myself. So.
I will, for all listening, there is a Packers t-shirt involved here, I should point out.
Is there a different team? Really? No. So, yeah, I mean, I was born and bred here. It's just, it's in our blood, you know? And when I was at the Governor's Conference on Tourism last year, I learned that the travel industry in Wisconsin got less federal relief dollars for COVID than any other Midwest state. And that kind of made me look at finishing this book a little differently. And that's when I realized I can use this book to give back to a lot of different areas and communities in Wisconsin that weren't going to see the money to help rebuild their businesses after COVID shut things down for a while.
Talking to Danelle Gay about her new book, 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your must-do, must-experience things around the state of Wisconsin, famous or not, big or small, local, or you can find them all over the place. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Danelle, let's start naming some names. What I love to see there is Dr. Evermore's Forever Tron. This is just, for a point of trivia, one of the very first radio interviews I ever did was with Tom Every, a.k.a. Dr. Evermore. Unique character, unique thing. People in the art world really do come to Wisconsin to see and experience this. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Folk art is incredible. And you just really have to experience it in the element that it was created. We talked for a little bit privately about the Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, and they have 35 samplings of different artists. But yeah, Forevertron, you just have to stand there at that place and kind of absorb it yourself. It's almost overwhelming, but it's so cool. You have to see it in person.
Excellent. Now, food and drink. Now, this is, talk about tough to narrow down. Let's see. You've got some Door County fish boil, and you picked one, and this is another one where you said, or... here's a whole bunch of others. Talk about the fish boil in Door County.
That's like dinner and a show built in. And I picked the one that, you know, I thought had the best show first, because that's the part you sit outside on the patio and you watch the master at work doing the fish boil, and they tell the stories and history of the area. And that's half of the fun. I mean, eating it is great, but it's really the show leading up to it in advance. But that's, again, that's another really cool Wisconsin experience.
That's Door County. What were some of the other great food traditions you wanted to highlight and then went looking for the right restaurant or venue to match them up with?
Well, you have to have a Kringle in Racine, because there's all the Danish people that settled there. Wisconsin, they have something called Booyah. It's a different kind of soup, and that's usually the area you're going to find it. So we had to look for that. You got to have Eat at a Wisconsin Supper Club. Mm-hmm. And the one that I featured, I mean, there's tons of amazing supper clubs, but I featured Cantafio's in Beaver Dam because they're a Gold Star family and they have a really neat story about what they do for veterans.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Well, they're a Gold Star family. They lost their son Ryan almost 20 years ago. And so they do free meals for veterans. And on Memorial Day, they usually do a free feed, a free meal from 4 to 8. And that's when I'll be there this year signing books on Memorial Day. And we're going to donate the profits to the Wounded Warrior Project in Ryan's name. So they're an incredible family.
Other experiences that go along with foods that, I mean, there's the famous Goats on the Roof restaurant.
Oh, definitely.
Talk about that a little bit. Al Johnson's?
Al Johnson's. And that started out kind of as a gag where somebody brought the goats over to him. But I mean, you have to have the Swedish pancakes with the lingonberries there. That's just a given.
And then a $100 burger.
Oh, yeah. Madison's got the $100 burger, if you haven't heard about that one.
It's not the burger, though.
Not the burger, no. At the Jet Room, you can get the $100 burger. But that also then, besides your burger, it gets you a ride around Madison in a plane.
Right. Now, I've been there to the Jet Room, and this is like right next to the airport there.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally, people park their planes and walk in and get breakfast or whatever.
Oh, and they have a beautiful wall of windows where you can watch all the airplanes, you know, landing and taking off, too.
That was a great one for kids. Now, let's get to some, let's go to museums now.
Ooh.
How about that? You've got some great ones. Milwaukee, and I've talked to the directors there, the Black Holocaust Museum.
That was an amazing experience. When we toured that, I took my teenager and their best friend. And that's the first time I've ever heard two teenagers quiet for almost 2 hours.
Wow.
It was an amazing experience. How they put everything together, the journey that you walk through history was just amazing. And the conversations we had in the car afterward were incredible too. They have this one thing where you're like walking underneath and it's like you're in the hold of a slave ship where you're like looking up and just, I invite you to go there and lay down underneath there and look and try and imagine what it would be like to be there and have that your only view for like 3 months in a transport. It's an incredible museum.
And then for a kind of an opposite experience, I remember with little kids running around and making noise and having a lot, just being super excited, railroad museums here in the state. Oh. We've got a few places to experience those.
Lots of great railroad museums. And, you know, from 2 to 102, who doesn't like trains? one of my favorite museums, Racine, the Racine Art Museum, they have their Peeps exhibition coming in. They have people from all over the world who send in their artwork, and they've made it from Peep candies. It's hilarious.
A lot of people would say that's the best use for Peeps.
Well, they float nicely in hot chocolate.
I know some people like to eat them, yeah. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Well, anyone in Madison would say take them to Old Brick Gardens.
The Botanical Gardens, sure. And Kay, I understand you've got one more to recommend to us as well?
Yes. Mater's German Restaurant in Milwaukee for wonderful German food.
What's your favorite thing to eat at Mater's in Milwaukee, Kay?
Sauerbraten.
Okay, Sauerbraten. I used to be a big Rouladen fan when I'd go to German restaurants. So the Botanical Gardens, I can't remember if that ended up in the book.
It's hard because we have so many amazing ones in Wisconsin. Right. And like I said, you had to balance out the state. I mean, I could easily do 100 things in just Madison for this book, but I couldn't. Somebody else wrote that. The gardens that I did feature is the Janesville Rotary Gardens, because they have the 1.5 million holiday light display. That's their biggest fundraiser for the year. But I mean, Green Bay, Old Brick Gardens, there's so many amazing, amazing gardens that are, you know, available for us in Wisconsin. And it's funny that you mentioned Mater's, because I just got the contract to write Unique Eats and Eateries of Wisconsin, and that's one of the ones on my list of 84 to connect with. I agree. Mater's is amazing.
Okay, thanks so much for sharing that. I appreciate that. And that highlights something else that kind of keeps coming up in your book, all the many ethnic traditions that Wisconsin has to draw from. That we've already talked about a couple of them. What are some more you might want to highlight?
Well, you know, amazing is a really amazing, well, it's an incredible state for the fact that so many different ethnic groups settled here, everyone from the Swedes to the Germans, and then all of the different industries. We had a logging and a fishing and a mining. So it's just, depending on where you go, there's something different and incredible to focus on.
We'll go back to our callers now. Scott is with us on the road on his way to Milwaukee now. Scott, hello.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to recommend, Scott?
Well, I would recommend going to GaryCon, which is a Dungeons & Dragons convention held in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. It's online. You wouldn't have any trouble finding it, except that it takes up all of the Grand Geneva Resort and Spa. So it's a pretty big convention these days. But it's so much fun because all the great old school gamers show up there.
Scott, thanks a lot. We've talked about Lake Geneva's origin story for Dungeons & Dragons, this game that changed the gaming world. Thanks for sharing that with us, Scott. Donnell, any thoughts on that one?
I was trying to work on a book that we'd had like fairs and celebrations and, you know, things like that that we could put in. So I'm working with that with my Midwest Travel Writer Network group. We're doing a couple of different books together, too. But Lake Geneva is beautiful. And, the Grand Geneva, I mean, it's just beautiful there.
Scott, thanks for sharing that. We're talking to travel writer and author Donnell Gay about her new book. It's called 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can offer your own recommendation. You could second one that our guest has made so far. If you work in service or tourism, what have things looked like over the last couple of years during the pandemic? Have you made big changes? Are you seeing more people coming back? What is your favorite thing to take an out-of-town visitor to in your neck of the woods? What is something that's still on your list? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Donnell Gay, Wisconsin-based travel writer and blogger. Her new book is called 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. She has 100, actually a lot more than 100, ideas, travel suggestions, places to go. And you could share yours too at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hello.
Hi. I think everybody should visit, at least in the summertime, Mineral Point.
What do you like about Mineral Point, Connie? Where should we stop?
Well, I tell you, there used to be a lot of antique craft shops there now. But the main thing you want to go to is the village. And for the life of me, I can't think of the name of it right now.
Pendarvis.
Yes. And that was one of the first places. I was born in Darlington. But when I got older, and that was one of the places I went so many times all summer long. So just thought I'd share that.
I love it, Connie. Thanks for sharing that and sharing that memory with us, too. Donnell, Mineral Point area.
Yeah, Pendarvis. And it's nicest because that the Wisconsin Historical Society has changed up how they do the tours. So it's more of kind of like a history, less of the mining community, but more of like the history and the redevelopment and the restoration that they've done. And then you also have to make time to go to the Red Rooster Cafe and get yourself a pasty.
Ooh, I love a good pasty. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there yet. Interesting. Connie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Joy is with us now in West Bend. Joy, hello.
Hi. What was really wonderful for us was to go to the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. They have one or more cranes of every species from the world. The only one that's not endangered is our sandhill cranes, which are coming back really strong. And they do work to save these cranes all over the world. And it's just beautiful to see them.
Joy, thanks so much. That is in the book, I know, didn't I?
It is. There's 15 different kinds of cranes, and it's amazing the work that they're doing there.
And thanks for that call, Joy. This is the kind of thing you're looking for. Like, if you're not from Wisconsin, would you think, oh yeah, Wisconsin, that's the place with the crane place?
No.
I doubt it. Right?
Right.
What other unexpected things are there like that that you came up with for your book or that you've seen that like, yeah, oh, you know, if you're from outside of Wisconsin, you wouldn't think we have blank cranes or what, or Forever Trons or whatever.
There's so many fun things in the book. Like if you're in Washburn County, in Spooner, they have a railroad where you can ride the Mark Twain Zephyr. 10 shovel nose steamers were made in the mid 30s. 2 of them are in our museum. The other ones are lost to time. And this one has been refurbished. And so it's the only place in the world that you can ride one of these shovel nose steamers. And they're doing a fantastic job with the Mark Twain Zephyr. It's beautiful.
Fantastic. Only in Wisconsin. Joy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us next in Madison. Tim, hello.
Hi. I second the International Crane Foundation and the Red Rooster, but Copper Falls State Park, I think, is a state park that everyone should go to.
What? Paint us a picture, Tim. Go ahead and do it. Yeah.
It's northern Wisconsin. It's just south of Ashland.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beautiful Iron River, I think, runs through that. I believe that's the name of it anyway. But there's a beautiful path that goes across the river in a couple different places. You have beautiful vistas and beautiful old growth white pines and cedars there. I think everyone owes it to themselves to see it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for sharing that. I kick myself. I haven't been. I love waterfalls. I've been in Wisconsin a long time. I've been to Ashland. I still haven't been to Copper Falls. Deno, you've got a few different parks of various sorts in the book. Where do you point us toward?
Oh, well, I do have several different parks in the book. I kind of balance them throughout the state. But my group of friends from the Midwest Travel Network, we have a new book coming out end of May, and it is Midwest State Park Adventures.
Uh-huh.
And so every single one of our 49 state parks is going to be represented in that book. So, yes, I've been all over the state parks. I love our state park system. The way that they handle everything is just beautiful.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Danelle Gay is with us. Her newest book is 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. You can keep sharing yours at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us next in Richland Center. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good afternoon. Down in Greene County, there's Nuglaris and Monroe. Monroe has cheese days every 2 years. It's a weekend event. They have a 3-hour parade each time. And also in Nuglaris, there's 3 events. There's a Heidi Festival during the summer. There's Swiss Independence Celebration is the first weekend, I think, in August. And then their big deal is the Will and Tell Festival over Labor Day weekend. Any of those is worth seeing.
Jim, thanks for the call. Nuglaris celebrating Wisconsin's Swiss heritage, Danelle.
The historic cheesemaking center down there, that's in the book. Absolutely fantastic. It's hard when you have a festival, especially every other year. But I love the heritage down there. And of course, Wisconsin cheese, I couldn't be prouder of that. I wear it on my head with 600 different kinds of cheese. And we have the largest amount of master cheesemakers than anywhere else in the world. It's an important area to visit.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. So many festivals in the state, Danelle. I know that must have been one of the hardest things to sift and winnow, as we say here in Wisconsin. You've got, I think, some UFOs on the agenda for us, though, when it comes to festival season.
There's 3 different places in Wisconsin that has a UFO festival. And so I picked the one that's the oldest. But yes, definitely. When you have a week where you can celebrate UFO sightings, that's just a fun hoot.
And one thing I liked about the book, too, I mean, you've got, you know, one at a time, you're 100. But after that, you've got some a seasonal plan and then travel itineraries. Like, I think there's an art travel plan, things like that. Can you give us some inspiration on a plan, you know, a long weekend or a week off with some great things to do in Wisconsin?
Well, and it really depends. I had to try and break that down. So sometimes when you have kids or if you're empty nesters or if you just have like a long weekend. But yeah, breaking up seasonally and then giving you ideas and different things in the area. So like in Milwaukee, I would do a couple of different restaurants, talk about some of the museums like the Milwaukee Art Museum, the America Black Holocaust Museum, Mobcraft Brewery. Oh, man, they are so fun. You have to get one of their pretzels that's like bigger than your head. And the names of the different beers are crowdfunded. So what they come up with, just it cracks me up. But try to do different things like that.
Let's bring another caller on. Mac is with us calling from Milwaukee. Mac, hello.
Hi. I was going to say Minocqua's Winter Park is a great place for people. It's one of the better, it's probably the best place outside of mountain regions to cross-country ski in the United States for now. And climate change is really threatening a lot of places to cross-country ski, but they still have really reliable snow there.
Mac, thanks for the call. I know Minocqua makes an appearance in the book tonight. I don't remember if it was the winter skiing, though.
I don't think it was. I'm trying to remember myself now off the top of my head.
Well, but northern Wisconsin, we haven't said too much. Well, what am I talking about? Copper Falls and now the Winter Park. Any other great northern Wisconsin? We talked a lot about
Northern
Wisconsin.
Train I was talking about, Washburn County. That's very northwest. They have everything from the Canoe Heritage Museum to just trying to think of some of the other fun things there. Perlick Distillery, that's a lot of fun. Instead of farm to fork, like a lot of great places in Wisconsin, they're farm to cup. They make incredible vodka and have a fun tasting room with craft cocktails.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last a little over a minute or so, now it's teasing us with some spring-like elements, you know, the rainy kinds anyway. What do you look forward to in spring in Wisconsin?
You know, our seasons are so beautiful. Our state parks, they're different every single season, so they're fun to get out and see just as, you know, the seasons change. But it's fun to just get back outside again and do a lot of things.
That I've gotten better at doing winter state parks, especially with COVID. I got, you know, those chains for the shoes. You don't slip and slide all over the place. Do you get out in any of the winter parks? Is there a favorite?
We tried snowshoeing this year. That was fun.
Where'd you go?
Went to a couple of different things. Janesville has a nice area down there. In even Sun Prairie, Wisconsin was doing something fun where it was a snowshoe by candlelight hike. And I've learned that's a lot of work. More so than I thought it was. It was a good workout.
Okay. And speaking of workouts, you mentioned a huge, busy signing schedule. Where are your next couple events?
Oh, my gosh. I'm a little all over. on April 3rd in Sun Prairie from 5 to 8 p.m., I'm at Salvatore's downtown Sun Prairie, and that's where we're officially kicking off the book, and all the profits that day go to the Sun Prairie Emergency Food Pantry. That's one of 45 so far that I have on my calendar. So if they go to travelingcheesehead.com/book-events, they can see my full calendar right now.
Awesome. Danielle, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Danielle Gay is a Wisconsin-based travel writer, blogger, and author. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. Well, if you have more suggestions you want to share with the world, want to show off something in your neck of the woods in particular, you can keep doing it. Share your favorites on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, lakes are cold right now. What does that mean for dangerous cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae? Find out what the changing seasons mean for algae blooms. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. What is the very last thing you do before you go to bed at night? The Washington Post Department of Data looked at a big national survey of time use to check out our most common pre-bedtime activities. Third place is a near tie between reading or playing a computer game or otherwise using a computer screen. Then it's a big jump to second place, washing and grooming, including, you know, toothbrushing, that kind of thing. Number one, though, by a pretty big margin, the last thing we do before going to bed is watching TV. I've talked to sleep experts who say watching screens right before bed might interfere with our sleep. But between the 40% who watch TV, the 6% who said computers, a lot of people are still doing it. Now, me, I'm not sure how to answer the question. The last thing I do before I lay down is I brush my teeth. But I often read after going to bed until I get sleepy enough to drop the book. Sometimes I read big, heavy books. I got to be careful or I drop it on myself. Then I'm really awake. So maybe TV isn't so bad. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the 2023 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest wrapped up last week. We'll talk to the creator behind the aged Gouda that took first prize. Now, a train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio earlier this month included 20 cars carrying hazardous materials. 10 of those cars came off the rails, 5 of which were carrying a chemical compound called vinyl chloride. It's a gas that's used to make a variety of plastics. It's harmful, though, when humans ingest significant amounts of it. The EPA and the railroad operator released the derailed vinyl chloride in a controlled burn to try and mitigate the risk to humans and other wildlife in the area. But the presence of the toxic chemicals created fear for the surrounding community and conservationists around the country. We're learning more now about what vinyl chloride actually is and what it's used for. Alex Jordan is Assistant Professor of Plastics Engineering in the Engineering Technology Department at UW-Stout. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us a little bit about, for those of us without a chemistry degree, what vinyl chloride is?
So vinyl chloride is the monomer that's used primarily to make the polymer or plastic polyvinyl chloride, PVC, which is recycling symbol number 3. It's largely, the vinyl chloride is largely derived from petroleum-based feedstocks, where we can convert low molecular weight gases, like ethane into ethylene, and crack that down and further convert that to become the vinyl chloride monomer.
And then you mentioned this is PVC. I think we've all encountered PVC pipes. There's a lot of products. I'm guessing this is an incredibly a common product if it's the VC in PVC.
Correct. And due to the nature of the VC monomer itself, it's largely used mostly entirely to manufacture PVC. So the demand for vinyl chloride largely follows the demand for PVC, which is linked to construction.
And then what form does vinyl chloride travel in, a liquid or a gas?
It's typically transported as a gas. It's usually transported or handled in a double wall container where it's stored inside one container. And then between the first and second container, there's an inert gas like nitrogen. So if there is a small leak in the inner container, there's a detector that can detect that leak as when the VC gas mixes with the nitrogen gas. And it'll trigger a safety shutoff where that goes to a like a residual underground storage facility. Now, when you're transporting it, you obviously don't have that residual facility, but OSHA and EPA regulations for handling the material are fairly stringent. So you have a lot of protection there.
And what is it about vinyl chloride that makes us want to be so careful with it?
It's a flammability risk, particularly in the presence of oxygen. It's also a known carcinogen. Actually, prior the early 70s and before, it was actually used as the aerosol propellant for various products. And then once we kind of realized that it's a carcinogen, it was removed from those applications.
And maybe a dumb question here, if we want to use PVC for various plastic purposes, do we have to have this vinyl chloride to make it, or are there workarounds?
Currently, there are no commercially commercially available or sustainable workarounds. So we really do use vinyl chloride monomer almost exclusively to make PVC. Typically, vinyl chloride monomer is refined from crude oil, and it's largely converted and polymerized into PVC at a site very close to, even sometimes in the same facility, that the VC monomer is actually created. And then once it's polymerized, we add stabilizers to it so that we can use it out in the environment. But even without the stabilizers, once it's converted into plastic pellet, it's very, very safe and stable.
Oh, that's interesting. So I'm hearing you say, usually if we're making vinyl chloride gas, we're using it on site to make something like PVC. But in this case, it was being transported. Do you have a sense of how much vinyl chloride is transported from site to site as opposed to used where it's made?
I don't actually have that in front of me.
Oh, that's fine. I was just popped into my head there. Now, when we talk about the toxicity of vinyl chloride, how does it compare to other chemicals that might be used in the plastic process?
It would be slightly more carcinogenic. A wide range of chemicals that are actually used to manufacture plastics. All plastics are derived from various monomers. For instance, polyethylene is derived from the ethylene monomer. Things like polystyrene are derived from the styrene monomer. You can have PET, recycling symbol 1, that's polyethylene terephthalate, comes from terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol. They all have some safety issues, but typically we will have those monomers with an inhibitor and a stabilizer for safety, as well as for protecting their reactivity so they don't form a polymer prematurely where we can't use it.
And I got to ask, Alex, before I let you go, whether it's people you know or your students or other media, is this accident in Ohio getting a lot of people interested in asking their local plastics engineering professor what this stuff is?
I've gotten quite a few questions. I know some of my colleagues have as well. A lot of people asking what we can use as a substitute for polyvinyl chloride, the polymer that comes from it. You can imagine that as demand for polyvinyl chloride would decrease if it could be replaced with other plastics or plastic composites, the demand for production and transport of vinyl chloride monomer would subsequently decrease.
And is there something that people are looking at as a substitute product for PVC?
Right now, the like the abrasion resistance and the chemical stability really make PVC ideal for like siding and piping applications. But there are people using things like cross-linked polyethylene, PEX, PEX tubing, and the competitive like PVC can be used for food-grade packaging. It's actually that safe. But you can also use things like polystyrene and PET. So as we learn more about the material science of various plastics, you may see some plastics come more into demand, and other plastics that have traditionally dominated certain markets may start to fall off in favor of other plastics.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Alex Jordan, assistant professor of plastics engineering at UW-Stout, with us to tell us a little more about how manufacturers make and use vinyl chloride, one of the toxic chemicals released in the train derailment earlier this month in East Palestine, Ohio. Coming up, the maker of the country's best cheese of the year joins us to share the story of his champion Gouda and the Wisconsin influences behind it. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the new U.S. champion cheesemaker joins us to talk about his winning Gouda and learning his craft here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about some mysterious trains.
Just off a highway in northwest Wisconsin's Washburn County sits a long string of parked rail cars of different shapes and sizes. A listener who regularly passes these rail cars was curious about them. So she reached out to Wisconsin to figure out why they are there. WPR's Andrea Anderson took a road trip to find the answer.
If you're driving north along Highway 53 between Spooner and Trigo, you'll see a long line of rail cars parked on tracks on your right. The line of different cars seems like it will never end. Mary Kay Lovejoy passes these rail cars on the way to her cabin in Bayfield County, and she's always wondered why they're parked here.
You know, I always wondered, do these move? Are they just here in storage? And then I got curious, well, are they related to the frac sand mining? Why are they there all the time?
The question led me to Greg Vreeland. He is the general manager of the Wisconsin Great Northern Railroad, a company that operates on the tracks where the mysterious rail cars are parked. Vreeland says a couple things determine if a rail car is moving from place to place: the global economy, and what commodities are in demand.
At various points of the year, railroad cars of specific types become surplus to the needs of the shipping community. When there are extra cars that need a place to park, the railroads and the owners of the cars work with the small, what they call short line railroads, to use extra pieces of track that are not being used for another purpose to store the cars on.
Vreeland leases 26 miles of tracks from the state of Wisconsin and Canadian National Railway. Some of the rail is used for scenic train rides his business runs. But the rail cars Lovejoy was curious about, those are parked on another portion of these leased tracks. Vreeland says there are close to 500 rail cars from companies around the world parked on a 6-mile portion of track. Most haul frac sand and have been sitting here for 1 to 3 years.
The frac sand market is currently depressed, so there's not the need for the number of cars that there was a few years ago. So consequently, there are a few hundred frac sand cars currently parked.
So to be honest, I'm a lot like Lovejoy. I've seen rail cars parked here many times as I travel to family cabins up north. And I've always wondered why they sit here. The tracks run nearly right alongside the highway, and the vehicle traffic is loud. Vreeland met me here to check out the line of rail cars. It looks even longer up close, and the cars are huge. Some have graffiti and look weathered, others appear new. And as he points out, some rail cars are round and others look like a rectangle.
The small cars, the short cars, are frac sand cars.
Regardless of what shape they take, rail cars are expensive to build. Their lifespan lasts decades. When they aren't being used, they're parked because it's more economical to store them until they're needed rather than scrap them. And companies try to place rail cars close to where they will be used. But finding storage can be difficult.
There are various times when a lot of cars need to be stored, you know, when we have a recession or a downturn. Unfortunately, storage becomes very short supply, and then cars, wherever they can find a place, they get stuck.
The economy also drives how often a rail car is pulled from the string. Vreeland staff could do it a few times a year or a few times a week.
Frac sand could be really big 2 months from now. You just never know. And if that happens, the phone will just ring off the hook. It's like, we need our cars back.
For now, the rail cars will sit here, waiting for the day they're needed to move goods from one place to another.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the sitting rail cars in Spooner. And that story idea came from a listener as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, most Wisconsinites know their way around a good cheese. You might have even had a cheese at some point that you say is the best in the nation. It's from Wisconsin, after all. But there actually is a best cheese in the United States, as decided by the U.S. Championship Cheese Contest last week in Green Bay. The winner was an aged Gouda called Europa. It didn't come from a farm in Wisconsin. The crown went to Arethusa Farm Dairy in Bantam, Connecticut. But don't worry, it's got strong Wisconsin ties. Eric Schmidt is the head cheesemaker at Arethusa Farm Dairy. He grew up in Monticello and worked for Wisconsin cheese producers for nearly a decade before moving to Connecticut last year. Eric, congratulations and welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on today.
Now tell us about Europa. What ended up making it the best cheese in the country?
Well, you know, all great cheese starts with great milk, and you really got to give it out, you know, give props to the dairy farmers in Litchfield County, Connecticut. They have great farming practices. They got really good herd management, and you know, you can't beat a, you know, a grass-fed milk out here. So
yeah, I wonder about that, because I think, oh, you know, the journey from milk to cheese, like a lot happens along the way, but that initial milk quality really does pay off in the end, Eric.
Oh, 100%. It makes, you know, milk quality is always number one. You can't, you know, just like you know, with anything, like if you're making bread, if you're starting off with bad flour, you're not going to have a great, a bad sourdough starter. You know, if you don't have the flavor there, if you don't have the good quality ingredient, you're not going to get a good quality product. So, you know, tip of the hat to Connecticut farmers on that one, and especially Arethusa Farm Dairy with their farming practices.
And I understand you'd entered this Europa, an aged Gouda, in earlier contest. Didn't do as well, and I guess part of the story was it hadn't aged quite enough?
Well, that's not true, actually. Oh, okay. So this Europa has taken multiple best of classes. This there's a cheese contest in the New England area called the Big E, which is like kind of like their big, like, you know, Wisconsin State Fair is the big fair. They kind of put it all together out here, and it's called the Big E. It's up in Massachusetts. This cheese actually took best of show at the Big E also. Okay. What I was referring to is I put in not only in the age Gouda category, but I put it in the Edamame Gouda category, and we didn't take top honors in the, you know, 1, 2, 3 for, you know, best of class. You know, we weren't in the top three. We got like 7th or 8th, I believe. And then the extra aged is what won the whole competition.
Gotcha. I see. Now, you are in Connecticut now, but we shouldn't feel too bad in Wisconsin, because as I mentioned, you've got a pretty strong Wisconsin connection. Can you tell us about your upbringing when it comes to making cheese here in the state?
Yeah, I mean, I was out of high school for almost a year. I needed a job. I was kind of doing the job bouncing thing. I was pretty aimless. And the first cheese factory I worked at was Chula Vista Cheese outside of Browntown, Wisconsin. That's really the starting point, you know, when I got into the commodity side of things. And the whole process really, really interested me. You know, fermentation has always been, you know, I don't know if I can say this, but when I was 19, I was actually making mead at home, you know.
As long as you weren't drinking it, it's fine.
No, I wasn't. But, you know, fermentation always had it was a surprising science to me, just because there's naturally occurring things in the environment we as humans harnessed. These things either on purpose or by accident, you know, it's just an amazing thing. And, you know, what really got me, brought me to the artisan side of things was I actually took a job when I was 23. I moved out to the state of Oregon and worked out on the coast, and I milked cows into the vat and made cheese. You know, I milked the cow, right? And, you know, I did the whole thing. So that really gave me the appreciation for artisan cheese. And I do want to say, you know, this is not only, you know, it's a huge win for the state of Connecticut, for dairymen across Connecticut, but it's also a huge win for artisan cheese, because this is, you know, it's handmade. It's hand flipped. There's no robots here. It is people coming in every day taking care of this cheese in a cellar. So it is a huge win.
Can you talk about what makes someone a good cheesemaker? It seems like it would take a lot of patience and attention to detail, both things I'm really bad at. What else makes someone, you know, a cheesemaker?
Well, patience, attention to detail, and, you know, it's just... You have to have the will to keep learning, because, you know, you can talk to any master cheesemaker, you can talk to any cheesemaker across the country. You never stop learning, because there's always some gremlin that pops up a new problem, you know, and that's what really, you know, has kept me going, is that problem solving aspect with cheese. There's always something to solve.
I want to bring things back to the award-winning Gouda now. Can you talk about its, you know, the history of this kind of cheese? What kind of tradition you were tying into here with Europa?
Dutch Gouda. It is a traditional Dutch Gouda recipe, and it's, you know, when I first started here, aged Gouda has always been one of my favorite cheeses, you know, just the way it's sweet, it's caramely, it's roasty. Then you have tyrosine development. Tyrosine development only occurs on a well-aged and well-made piece of cheese. And it had all that, and it quickly became one of my favorite cheeses here. And it's traditional, you know, we're cooking with water, you know, it's a wash curd style cheese. So we actually, instead of like using our steam jacket, we're actually removing whey, which is, you're doing two different things. So you're removing part of the food, which is lactose, that's in the whey, and then you're adding water, which is sweetening up that curd. And then you're actually providing a heat source for you to kickstart that lactic acid to produce, or lactic acid bacteria to start, start fermenting.
And Eric, just very briefly, you've conquered aged Gouda now. Do you have an aspirational cheese? Like, I want to make that kind of cheese next.
Yeah, of course. I've been partial to cloth-bound cheddars. I know everyone kind of has a cloth-bound cheddar nowadays. One of the top 20s were up at the U.S. Championship this year was made by Redhead Creamery in Minnesota. They have a great cloth-bound cheddar. That's one that's in my sights. We currently do not make a cloth-bound cheddar. We make a cheddar, but we actually just butter it, and it's a natural rinded cheddar. But that would probably be the next cheese. Excellent. In my sights to kind of perfecting, because this Europa was such a great recipe to start with.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Eric Schmid, head cheesemaker at Arethusa Farm Dairy in Bantam, Connecticut, winner of the 2023 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest held here in Wisconsin. Sounds like some good cheese. I'm hungry for some aged Gouda. I'll eat that coming up on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then new data from the CDC shows record high levels of sadness, violence, and risk of suicide for teenage girls. We'll talk with a children's health expert here in Wisconsin about what's behind those numbers, what we can do to turn things around. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.